Hello and welcome to The Case Files. I'm Kate Jabot, and over the course of this podcast series, I'll be bringing you the true life stories behind some of the UK's most fascinating legal cases, all told with unparalleled access to the people and lawyers closest to events. In this episode, we'll hear about the devastation left behind by disgraced surgeon Ian Paterson. Paterson subjected nearly 1,000 patients to totally unnecessary or extremely risky invasive operations over a 14-year period. He told some of his victims they had cancer when they didn't. He used surgical techniques that were dangerous and untested. He toyed with the emotions of both his patients and their loved ones. And as a consequence, some lost their lives. We'll hear from the man whose wife was subjected to dozens of operations by Paterson as the surgeon tried to fix problems he himself had caused.
My wife was operated on numerous times. My wife had been cut back to front, top to bottom, chasing cancerous cells all the time.
One patient was told that her surgery had been pointless.
There's two specialists studied your operations and you didn't need to have one. Well, you could have knocked us down with a feather. Just couldn't believe what he'd done.
We find out how Paterson used his power to emotionally manipulate his patients.
And I've got some guy who's told me the night before that I'm going to lose her, and the next morning he's going to save her, my hero.
And how he ruthlessly operated again and again and again.
The most shocking part was deliberately lying to patients and GPs. And really conning people into having unnecessary surgery. I remember one patient who had at least 10 unnecessary operations. It was really shocking. To think that, you know, a member of the medical profession could do that is really quite hard to understand.
Ian Paterson was a busy surgeon in Birmingham. He worked for the Heart of England NHS Trust and at two private hospitals run by Spire Healthcare. He did several kinds of surgery, but he was best known as a breast surgeon, operating on hundreds of women. Many GPs saw him as the go-to breast specialist, and many of his patients thought extremely highly of him. But in reality, his work was criminally flawed. He was putting lives in danger with risky and unapproved surgical techniques, disfiguring women through unnecessary operations, and exaggerating his patients' risk of cancer. Eventually, the truth caught up with him, and in April 2017, the 60-year-old father of three was jailed for 20 counts of unlawfully wounding his patients. He was found to have carried out extensive, life-changing operations for no medically justifiable reason. While he was only charged with crimes relating to 9 women and 1 man between 1997 and 2011, the reality was that he had hundreds of victims. One of the reasons he got away with his crimes for so long was because of significant failings in how he was managed by hospital staff in both the NHS and the private sector. As a result, the NHS, Spire and Paterson were all sued for compensation. So far, £37 million has been paid out to help hundreds of patients and their relatives. This was an incredibly challenging case from a legal perspective, with hundreds of victims and multiple defendants. It took years to bring him to justice and for the impact on his victims to be recognised. Paterson had abused one of the most important relationships in society, the trust between patient and doctor. To understand the horrific nature of Paterson's crimes, we'll hear from two of his patients, Carol Johnson and Jade Edgington, as well as John Hines, whose wife Deborah was treated by Paterson. Carol Johnson went to see Ian Paterson, along with her husband Barry, after finding a lump in her breast in 2002. She told me how she felt when she first met him.
So, so nice. Such a gentleman. And he said, "Don't worry, we'll sort it. Whatever it is, I'll send you for a mammogram and a scan." After the mammogram and the scan, he called us back in and he done a biopsy, drained the fluid and said it had definitely got to be removed. It was bordering on the grey area of cancer. So went in, come home and told the family. I'd got 3 children and they're all old enough to understand. And we went and he removed it. So to me, he was marvellous. He was God.
Carol began to suffer repeated lumps, and over the next 6 years, she returned time and time again to see Patterson.
I kept getting these lumps and went back, referred again by the GP, and he said X-ray and scan again, and looked at the scans and he went, it's another definite lump that's got to come out, it's got to go. So you just believed every word he said.
And how many times did he find these lumps and operate on you?
He actually operated 7 times, but there was only paperwork for 6 operations. But we know, my husband and myself know, it was 7.
Carol ran a pub with her husband at the time, meeting a lot of people, and she was happy to tell him about Patterson.
I did always recommend Dr. Patterson to people. If you got girls coming in, you'd get talking and I'd say, oh, I've found a lump or anything like that. I'd say, go to Mr. Patterson. Fantastic. He's the best. And on a couple of occasions, people have said, well, I've heard different stories about him. And I went, it's just gossip. Just gossip.
But there was more than gossip. Carol's GP was also suspicious.
On a couple of occasions, my GP had said, I don't think you should have had that removed. And I did say to him, well, he's the specialist. He knows what he's doing. He's more specialised in it than you are.
Carol didn't know it, but Patterson had been the subject of repeated complaints from patients and colleagues. Had authorities acted on warning signs, his crimes could have been stopped in December 2007. However, despite at least 3 investigations, 4 complaints to the General Medical Council and repeated orders to stop performing certain procedures, Patterson continued operating on patients until August 2011. The authorities' apparent impotence gave Patterson a sense of impunity, and he continued to carry out dangerous and unauthorised operations. When the medical establishment eventually woke up to what Patterson was doing and began to review his work, Carol was one of those whose treatment was investigated by another surgeon.
He went through every breast lump I'd had, and he said, what did you think of Mr. Patterson? And we said, he's a gentleman, he's understanding, he's friendly, which he did appear to be. It's so nice. And we, you know, he said, well, I'm going to tell you now, and I don't know how you're going to take this, he said. There's 2 specialists studied your operations and you didn't need to have one. Well, you could have knocked us down with a feather. You know, I just couldn't believe what he'd done. And I thought, and he calls himself a doctor. Why did he do it? And to this day, I still don't know why he would have done what he's done. There was no need to have one operation.
This is one of many cases where Patterson was found to have carried out totally unnecessary operations. Professor Gordon Wishart is a specialist breast cancer surgeon who reviewed Carol's case and some 200 others. He told me that Patterson didn't even have the basic qualifications for the job he was doing.
It's quite obvious when you look at his CV that he never formally trained as a breast surgeon, so he never spent time in a recognised breast unit in the UK. And so it was amazing that he was ever allowed to, you know, be employed as a consultant breast surgeon. His CV clearly shows that he was trained in general and vascular surgery, and he was very academic. He presented lots of papers. He wrote an MD thesis on vascular surgery. But he did nothing at all in terms of breast cancer research or audit or training.
How does someone get into that position then if they don't have the qualifications they should have?
I think it was a very difficult time from in the early 90s when training was really moving from being general surgery to more specialised type of surgery. But clearly, I think there was a lack of governance in the appointment committees that allowed him to be appointed as a general surgeon and then to become head of breast surgery, which seems incredibly strange.
Let's turn now to John Hines. John's wife Deborah's case is even more serious than Carol's. The couple had two young daughters when they went to Patterson's surgery in the year 2000.
My wife's first contact was an initial consultation on a Saturday morning, being referred to Mr. Patterson by our GP, and she went along just to have a breast checked, basically. Her nipple was inverted a little bit, and the GP was concerned and referred her to Mr. Patterson. And her first meeting was to have that breast looked at, and on that morning he undertook a procedure which basically did a sort of a biopsy, and that was her first contact with him, which was a fairly traumatic experience in itself. So
what happened then the first time she saw him?
Well, I mean, the hospital that she attended is nearby, only 3 miles, so it was only a 10-minute drive, and we anticipated she'd be gone more than an hour. In the end, she'd been gone for 2 hours, and during that period she was with him, he gave her an injection to remove some fluid from the breast, which was to be sent away to be examined. The experience was extremely painful. She was quite traumatised when she got back. She'd been gone for 2 or 3 hours and really upset her. It was a very painful procedure.
And what did you know about this man before? Why were you sent to him?
Well, our GP, who's been our GP for a number of years, referred us. And we were told he was the best, he was their top man. And we were quite pleased that we were going to see the best person suitable to look at my wife's condition.
Deborah came home later than expected and in some pain. She told John she'd been given bad news.
She told me, she said, he said, I've got cancer. So she'd got the shock of the news and she'd got the experience itself. And those two things together really, really upset her. It upset all of us. You know.
So he said, you've got breast cancer.
Yeah.
What else did he say? What was the next?
That what he'd need to do is to do a full biopsy and he would be calling her back. Now, that was Saturday morning. And true to his word, Wednesday evening, my wife was scheduled in for a proper biopsy to remove some of the tissue.
And then what happened?
So we went along on the Wednesday night. My daughters were there, my young daughters. My in-laws were there. Deborah was taken down to surgery. She was gone for about an hour. She came back. She was asleep. My daughters were playing in the corridor. And he came in the room. I'm in the room with Deborah on my own. And he basically confirmed that there was a tumour there, that it was a large tumour, substantial tumour, that it was starting to attach itself to the breastbone, and that, you know, it was malignant, and that in his view, untreatable, and the best he could do was to give her maybe 2-3 years, and he would make her comfortable and do what he could to make her comfortable in that period of time. You know, he's just gone for a biopsy. He hasn't gone off to pathology or anything like that, but he's an expert, so we've taken him at his word. So that night was a pretty traumatic night for the rest of us, Deborah's parents and myself. Deborah, of course, was totally unaware of any of this because she's unconscious and recovering after surgery.
Deborah slept overnight. John spent a terrible evening with her devastated parents and returned early the next day. Patterson came back on his rounds.
Like a knight in shining armour, he came in and he... Deborah's unaware, by the way, of his what he's told me at this point.
That she's got terminal cancer.
And that she's got a certain amount of time to live. And then he quite literally says, I've had a good think about it overnight. I think I can save her. To which I was more than relieved, more than happy. However, I do need to do a mastectomy very, very quickly.
So there's a man who's given you the results before it's been sent off to be analysed.
Yeah.
He said it's terminal. He comes back the next day and says, actually, I can save her. Did you actually think rationally at that time, or were you?
No. I mean, you quite literally, you know, it's a new experience. You're on a roller coaster. I've got the most important thing in my life lying there. And I've got some guy who's told me the night before that I'm going to lose her. And the next morning he's going to save her. My hero.
Deborah had her mastectomy. John told me how it was explained to them.
What we were described as Deborah was going to undertake was a cleavage-sparing mastectomy. And we didn't have any reason to say, well, is there another type or any type? We were just in the hands of the person who's the expert. But what he did say was that it gave a better result, and especially if you're going to have reconstructive surgery, which we always planned to do, this helped. At no point was there ever a bargain to be struck about risking this particular type of mastectomy and not having a positive outcome.
Professor Wishart, who reviewed Patterson's work, was shocked when he heard about what Patterson called cleavage-saving mastectomies.
To introduce a new surgical technique, you have to do a research study, you have to look at the safety of it, you have to publish the results, try to persuade your colleagues that
people knew he was doing it, though?
I think, well, I'd never heard of the name. Yeah. Most breast surgeons and you will never have heard of this technique. It seemed to be a Birmingham thing, and just him.
Deborah went on to have a breast reconstruction. It was at this point it was discovered that not all the cancer had been removed.
It was the plastic surgeon who visibly, without referring to pathology, who spoke to us straight after the surgery, said to us, Deborah was in intensive care after a reconstruction, that she was highly suspicious of the tissue that she was handling whilst doing the reconstructive surgery.
So what did you do?
Well, what she did was to confirm results. She sent it off to pathology and she confirmed that there was cancerous tissue left from the original surgery, and she'd actually been handling the cancerous tissue during the reconstruction. So it meant correcting the reconstruction, it meant eradicating the cancerous cells. So Deborah then went into radiotherapy and further chemotherapy.
What did Ian Patterson say about this?
Not a lot in defence, and of course we weren't making any accusations. I mean, we had no idea that the cancerous cells were as a consequence of the procedure he undertook. We had no reason to believe that it wasn't just cancer that could have, you know, formed in any part of a body. So we weren't pointing any fingers, we weren't really asking questions in the sense that, well, how's that happened?
Over the years, the cancer cells left inside Deborah spread to different parts of her body. Ian Patterson operated on her again and again.
My wife was operated on numerous times. My wife had been cut back to front, top to bottom, chasing cancerous cells all the time. And Mr. Patterson was always the surgeon that performed those operations.
Did you at any point have any doubt about him?
No, because to all intents and purposes, we'd be referred to the best. We were at a state-of-the-art private hospital in Birmingham. All the brochures, the whole surroundings, the ambience, everything says professional, professional, professional. This is the man. Why would you question him? Why would you have any reason to doubt?
But over time, the concerns about Patterson mounted up. Complaints by staff led to investigations by the medical authorities and the police. John told me that at first, they didn't want to believe it.
I think one of the first things you do is you go into a defence mechanism saying, but it can't be us. No, we've not been subjected. It must have done it to other people. And then as the facts unfold and people start telling similar stories, and you say, well, that's a bit like us. That is us. We're one of those. You know, we're one of the victims of this. So you go into... Your emotions are mixed. I mean, you're still fighting cancer. You're still dealing with it, and then you start saying, "Yeah, but surely we weren't victims." You know, you try and escape it, if you like, the realization that you actually could be.
And when you realised you were,
yeah. Well, you feel angry. You feel bitter. You know he's being exposed now because it's in the papers. You know there's legal proceedings because it's reporting, the police are investigating. And it becomes more real when you're actually approached by the authorities and the police and asked for permission to access your records and things like that. You go, oh dear. And it's difficult because you've got that going on, but you're still in a fight. You're still fighting cancer. So this is now background noise because the cancer hasn't gone away and the risk of, you know, your life being changed forever hasn't gone away.
Deborah's story is like many others. those whose treatment by Patterson didn't remove as much cancer as it should have done, leaving them vulnerable to the disease recurring. Let's hear from our third patient, Patterson's youngest victim. She's Jade Edgington, just 16 when she came into Ian Patterson's surgery. Again, she had no reason not to trust him.
He's lovely. It's a really weird thing to talk about now, knowing what we know. But at the time, he was absolutely lovely. So I went with my mum and dad, and they absolutely loved him as well. We felt really looked after. You felt like you were in really good hands. He was very charismatic. He was laughing, joking, you know, very, very friendly. Never a doubt in your mind that he didn't have your best interests kind of at heart.
So his bedside manner was just impeccable,
yeah,
was it?
Yeah, absolutely great. You know, as a 16-year-old, having to get your chest out in front of a kind of a middle-aged man, if you like, is a bit of a weird situation. So, but I did not ever feel uncomfortable. He made you feel really, really relaxed and at home. So we thought he was great.
So what did he say?
He said that it was a fibroadenoma, which is kind of like a cyst, but it needed to come out, basically. It could affect me breastfeeding. I was 16, my body was still growing and changing. It could have affected how aesthetically I looked and things like that. So it needed to come out.
So you had the procedure?
Yep. My dad still talks about it to this day. He said I kind of looked at him, obviously was worried, never been under general anaesthetic or anything like that before. And he just said, if the doctor says you need it out, Jade, you need it out. And he always feels really guilty about it now because he kind of feels that he put me in that situation. And he didn't. Patterson put me in that situation.
And Patterson got the opportunity to operate on Jade again because over time, her lumps came back.
I ended up having a further three operations over the next kind of 3 or 4 years for the same thing. So for lumps, I had a lump in the scar, which was growing. So again, he just said, no problem, we'll just whack that out. And it was very, very blasé, like, yeah, no problem. Like, it was almost as if he was doing you a favour. It was like, yeah, don't worry, we'll sort it. Don't stress about it. Get in, we'll get it done.
In terms of getting over the procedure each time, it's not nothing, is it? Let's face it, general anaesthetic, you've been cut.
Yeah, I think having stitches out around the area as well is obviously such a sensitive area. I always remember that being absolutely awful every time, having to have the stitches taken out.
As the news of cases being reviewed came out, Jade waited to see how she might be affected.
We'd heard through the grapevine that people were being recalled because I think all the cancer patients were recalled first. So we'd heard, because we knew people that had operations by him as well. So we'd heard that people were getting recalled. And then I got a letter a bit later, kind of down the line, a couple of months later, to say that they were just investigating it at that point, and there was an expert kind of looking into it. And so we had to go in for an appointment at Parkway and see a different doctor. And that's when they kind of told us then, like, there was some question over whether the operation should have been done or not. And I was basically told that the first lump was quite large, so that what they would have done is monitored it, and if it had grown then or changed, then they would have taken it out. But other than that, I wouldn't have had any of the operations.
So Jade never needed to be operated on, and each unnecessary operation left his victims vulnerable to infection, in considerable pain, with lifelong scars, and some were left disfigured. He also left them dealing with the emotional turmoil of having to tell their loved ones that they had cancer or a risk of cancer, that they had to be operated on, that there was a chance they might die. His crimes were physical, but the nature of his job meant that there was an emotional impact on victims and their families. He was toying with their emotions, and sometimes his mask would slip. As well as treating Deborah, Patterson had performed a vasectomy on John Hines. It left him in a lot of pain, and he had to go to hospital.
Saturday night, I was in accident and emergency, being treated for a reaction to the vasectomy. And they explained to me, you've had a bad reaction with the antiseptic they treat you with, and so forth. And I remember going back to see him on the Wednesday and just highlighted that I had a reaction, and the guy flipped.
What did he do?
That's nothing to do with me. How dare you criticise? And going, well, it's the same area. It's the same area that you've operated on. I've never had a problem before. 12 hours later, I'm in accident and emergency, and these people are telling me to do what happened this morning. And he was absolutely in denial. But not just in denial. It wasn't, I'm sorry about that. Maybe it did. that can happen. No, it was straight into defensive mode, and he turned on a sixpence.
Carroll also recalled another side to his character.
One of the things he did remark about was that my boobs hadn't changed since I was 18. I'd got 18-year-old boobs. And he said that Barry was a lucky man.
Did that not strike you as a bit unusual?
Well, I just thought, he said, if you was looking on an X-ray, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between mine and an 18-year-old's, because apparently they're lumpy and bumpy. And that is why I was getting these lumps.
Professor Wishart also remembers Patterson from his one encounter with him.
I did meet him in, I think, 2009 at a kind of small conference in Birmingham. It was very obvious that he ruled the roost amongst the breast surgeons, who were quite scared to answer questions in his presence without his approval. And I came away thinking that he was definitely arrogant, and he seemed to have a real control over the other breast surgeons. So he was probably a bully as well, I think.
This capacity to turn angry might be one clue as to how Patterson got away with it. Let's hear now from Emma Doughty, head of clinical negligence at Slater and Gordon, who helped more than 100 patients in their battle for justice. Emma told me the staggering numbers of people affected by the generic litigation.
With the generic litigation, when we settled the case, there were approximately 780 claimants included within that settlement. But then the trust that had been set up by the compensation that the defendants paid was open for a year after settlement in 2017. And more people did come forward after that, a good few more hundred people. So in terms of the number that came forward to us, you're looking at around 1,000, over 1,000 people. But that's not to say that there weren't people who didn't come forward.
So you brought a civil case against whom, and what did you get?
So we brought a civil case against Mr. Patterson, against Spire Hospital, and against the NHS Heart of England Foundation Trust. And the claim was settled in September 2017 for £37 million.
She explains why nothing was ever done to stop Patterson.
The people that he worked with didn't feel enabled to speak up, to, properly speak to the management about what they could see was going on. There are a number of times when some people did try, which resulted in audits of his work, which didn't seem to go anywhere. The results just sat with management, just went in a drawer, and nothing happened. We think that this is because actually Patterson was doing what the management wanted, which was he was doing things quickly, he was making the money, and so, you know, they weren't particularly interested in the performance of his work.
But GPs complained, patients complained.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems that those complaints were sort of dealt with, but sort of glossed over, and there were no real outcomes at all until 2011, when one of his colleagues blew the whistle finally.
There were many missed opportunities to stop Patterson. Patients and GPs complained. Concerns about Patterson were raised as far back as 2003. And despite several internal and external investigations and complaints, the General Medical Council did not suspend him until 2011. He was explicitly told to stop performing procedures in 2008, but continued for more than a year. None of it stopped him harming more patients. Professor Wishart says the worst thing about Patterson's action is his dishonesty.
I think the most shocking part was deliberately lying to patients and GPs and really conning people into having unnecessary surgery, and then propagating that lie for many years afterwards by recommending that they had unnecessary follow-up. And I think seeing people, I remember one patient who had at least 10 unnecessary operations, it was really shocking. To think that you know, a member of the medical profession could do that is really quite hard to understand.
Do you have a theory or an idea of why he did what he did?
I think He was clearly very bright when you look at his CV, very academic, very bright. I suspect that his chosen specialty of vascular surgery requires real technical skill, a high level of technical skill. And from the reviews that I've seen of his breast surgery, he did not have that. So I can only suspect that he was stopped from progressing to becoming a consultant vascular surgeon and then really moved sideways into perhaps what was seen as a lesser surgical specialty at that time.
Emma Doughty has sifted through all the evidence. She says there are different theories as to why Patterson behaved as he did.
The first is that he'd sort of become this sort of, in his own mind, this god who could do no wrong, and, you know, he was doing surgeries so quickly and nobody could touch him, and he was making lots of money for the private sector, and it just grew and grew, and, you know, with that grew his ego, as it were. And then the second theory is that it was all born out of money and, you know, wanting to make as much money as possible in the private sector. It's very difficult to pick through because Mr. Patterson, you know, himself didn't ever give a statement in the civil litigation.
Whatever his motive, Patterson was able to carry on operating for years despite suspicions. How does Carol Johnson feel about the way Patterson got away with it for so long?
Annoyed, because people did know and people were scared of saying anything because of losing their jobs. But people did know what he was doing and should never have been allowed to continue, but he did.
Patterson, who protested his innocence, refused to speak in his own defence at both the criminal and civil cases, so we'll probably never know what was in his mind as he hurt so many people. Because of this, his victims will never truly get the closure they deserve. Even behind bars, he still holds power over his victims. Patterson was sentenced to 15 years in jail originally, which was then increased on review to 20. Carol was one of the patients who took the stand to testify.
If nobody made a stand, he would still be doing what he did. So I'm quite proud that I did what I did and the others, because we did what we did, and he got to put down for it. Otherwise, how do we know that he wouldn't be operating somewhere else?
Patterson's youngest victim, Jade Edgington, looks back on what happened with mixed feelings.
I think that's one thing that I find difficult, I guess, talking about, because I feel like relatively lucky. You know, I didn't have cancer. I was never told that I had cancer, whereas, you know, a lot of people were told they had cancer and they didn't. Imagine delivering that news to their family and all kinds of things like that. And I never had to go through that part of it. I think the most difficult part for me was being so young and my body still changing. The operations could have impacted the way that, you know, my body looked. Well, they have impacted the way my body looked. You know, I've still got scars. I'm going to have scars forever. So I think that I felt just sick to my stomach about all the kind of skin-sparing mastectomies and things that he'd done. I think that for me was a really, really big one, because he was putting their life directly in danger.
Patterson's botched mastectomies did indeed cost lives. Deborah Hines died in 2013, 5 years before Patterson's convictions. She was just 51 years old, leaving behind John and their two daughters.
Everybody just loved her. She never forgot a name, never forgot a face. 13 years of cancer, cut from top to bottom, back to front, and the first thing out of my wife's mouth when she met anybody is, "How are you?" And if anybody said, "Well, how are you?" she'd say, "I'm fine," and even to the last day.
Do you think he was responsible for her death?
Oh, absolutely, 100%, without a doubt. If he'd have done what he was supposed to do in the first place, and that was to remove all of the cancerous tissue, then I am absolutely adamant that my wife would be. I remember the oncologist after the initial surgery saying to my wife, because my wife, obviously with two young children, she's only 38. We've got a diagnosis that says you'll be dead in 3 years. Now we're going to save you. So it was on my wife's mind. I remember talking to the oncologist and he says, "Mrs. Hines, you will definitely die one day." He said, "But you'll probably be 80 and it won't be from cancer." because that's how sure we were it was fixed, only to find out that 18 months post the initial surgery, during the reconstruction, that the cancerous cells were still there.
He's got 20 years, hasn't he, for what he did?
It's 20 years. You know, let's be honest, he'll be out now for that. I'm 59 now, so probably got 30 years left myself. Yeah, I'm in good health. So I get 30 years, he gets 20. I've done nothing wrong, and he'll be out in 10.
Thanks to John for telling us about Deborah Hines. Thanks also to Jade Edgington and Carol Johnson, as well as the breast cancer surgeon, Professor Gordon Wishart, who reviewed Patterson's work, and Emma Doughty from Slater and Gordon, who represented more than 100 of his patients. If you want to know more about this story or other episodes of The Case Files, have a look at our website, slatergordon.co.uk/podcast, or head over to our social media channels and search #CaseFilesPod and join the conversation. I'm Kate Chabot. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.